Good day, everyone. My name is Marge Twisdale, and you are tuning into Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here at 101.9 FM, KVSH. You are listening to Voice of Vashon, and today I am going to be chatting with a friend of mine who has also recently published a great book that I think can benefit everyone. So my friend is Marla Williams, and the book is called The Being Zone. Marla, how are you today?
I am great.
Excellent. I am so glad we were able to make this fit into our schedules. So real quick, if you can ground yourself for the people who are listening today and let them know a bit about you, and then we'll dive into the interview.
I would love to. So I am a life, career, and business coach who took what I learned as a coach and turned it into a book because I would like to reach more people in the world to help them live a happier, healthier life than what I see many people living. And I can't get to everyone with one-on-one coaching, so I've created and written this book to assist people who really want to make their life nicer, a better place, where they're happier and healthier.
Right. Right. Okie doke. Well, and I can imagine that makes a lot of sense for someone in your field because, as you say, you know, coaching is sort of, what's the word for it, time costly. You know, it's like literally an hour with someone. That's an hour out of your day. And there are millions of people in the world. So this book seems like just really a gift. I think it's really wonderful that you're offering up these tools that how many years did you spend sort of like developing or researching the background information that you use when you're coaching with people?
So I've been coaching for 10 years, and right. All those years, I was I'm a lifelong learner. I was learning and building what worked for me and what worked for my clients. And then all of that information that I've worked on for those 10 years, I was able to just kind of pare down and put into the book in a way that would be helpful to people. I really feel good about where I got to and how helpful it is. And the few people that have finished the book, because I just launched it here a few weeks ago, that have finished the book have said it's been transformational for them. And I'm getting 5-star reviews and a lot of wonderful feedback.
Well, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all. Coaching is such an amazing field. I'm really glad that it's sort of evolved because it seems to have risen up in the midst of what we knew beforehand, which would be you might go see a therapist or a psychologist, but coaching seems to have a very different feel. What's your perception for people who aren't sure what coaching is, just to make sure they're really on board with us?
So when I first got into coaching, I was an HR manager for years, so I was used to coaching and counseling with people as a human resource manager. And when I moved into coaching, intentionally moved into that field, a lot of people felt there was like a stigma if you went to see a psychologist or you had to see a therapist.
I think also it may actually be a legal requirement, especially if insurance is covering the cost of, you know, therapy, counseling, see a psychologist, whatever. I'm pretty sure that the people who work in that field are required to give a diagnosis, you know, so you end up getting labeled, and the labels are within this large book, the DSM, whichever one they're using at the time, and it's all labels based upon basically illness or sickness. So I think in a way, right, people do feel like, I don't really want to go hang out with someone who's going to tell me what's wrong with me and then how they're going to heal me from that illness. Whereas coaching, it's like, hey, all right, where are you at? Where do you want to go? What's going on? How can we get you there? It feels like it's a pretty positive glass half full type of approach.
Yes, very good description. Perfect.
Okay.
Instead of identifying what's wrong, it's what can we do to make you better, happier.
Yeah. All right, awesome. So you have all of my guests on this show have what's called an inciting incident in their own life, and that's a term usually reserved for fiction. It's that moment when early on in a book, you know, your protagonist is going along, life is normal, and then something happens, and as a result, the story really begins. They have to make a change, and it's usually a big shift, and they're launched in the direction that the story will take them. You had a personal inciting incident that sort of brought you towards The Being Zone, which is the name of the book. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
I will, absolutely. So what it was is my life was high stress, and I kept getting autoimmune stress-related diseases. And then one day my doctor came to me and he said, Marla, if you don't quit, you will die. Because I didn't know how to say no. And I was always on trying to do my best and please others and meet deadlines. And I drove myself to a point where I could have died. And that was my wake-up call. That was my big shift in life, because I had gotten several stress-related diseases along the way, but it was never life-threatening. And I came by being living a stressful life based on my own upbringing. My mom was a worrier, and I came by it naturally. My dad was really driven and was my role model. So between my mom worrying and my dad being very driven, I had both of those characteristics within me, which mm-hmm. started leading to the stress-related. So I had to learn to turn off the worry, mm-hmm. and I had to learn I could still be driven and accomplish a lot, but I didn't need to be quite so much a type A personality where I was just pushing and driving and all the time. I had to learn to operate in what I call the zone, the being zone.
And you said before you felt like you were in the doing zone.
I lived in the doing zone. Right. And that is what I teach people, is how to move from that place where you always are busy or have to be busy or don't feel you can quit, to a place where you can just be present in the moment. And you're actually, believe it or not, and it took me a long time, many years to figure this out, you're actually more productive when you operate in the being zone than when you operate in the doing zone. Mm-hmm. Because the doing zone is full of goals and lists and checks, and you're pushing yourself all the time. And the being zone is kind of having that point that you're working towards and have a knowing that you will get there, and you allow things to unfold in front of you instead of pushing your way through life.
All of which, of course, sounds so completely different from the overall societal messaging that we all receive.
Exactly.
I mean, there's probably 10, 20,000 books that have been written about how to go be successful by being in the doing zone.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The 4-minute workday or 4-hour workday, I guess it is.
Right.
I don't know how you do it in 4 minutes. But yeah, everybody talks about how to achieve more and do more and add this to your plate and add that. And if you just do this and you just do that. And I got caught right up in that. And I was living that life and killing myself day after day after day. Mm-hmm. And till I finally realized that I could die if I didn't stop. And I had to change how I approached life and how I responded to these pressures. And I was successful. And I've gotten better and better and better at it with each passing year. Mm-hmm. And then I started teaching clients it. And then I got a better understanding of why it worked and how it worked for them, and learn that every person's different, and different people need different tools and experiences to get to where I'm at. Not everybody's just like me, mm-hmm. but the tools and the advice and the guidance that I offer gives them opportunities that if they take advantage of it, they can, in fact, change their life.
So we're going to go through a number of different things. We have a full hour, which is really beautiful, and we're only about 1/5 of the way through. So we've got plenty to get into, folks. But I want, the thing that's coming to mind for me right now is, I think there are some people who are in the doing zone because they are pursuing sort of elective choices. You know, they have their basic needs met, but they want to climb up the ladder, or they want to achieve accolades or recognition from their peers. And none of these are things I'm critical of. They all make a lot of sense. So there are people who, they have their basic needs met, but they're in the doing zone by choice, we could say. And then I wonder that there are people out there who perhaps the perception we have as society is that there are a number of people in the world and or our own culture who they don't have enough, and so they're out there, you know, the stereotypic idea of working two jobs and, you know, the stressed out, really, really miserable person who's living in poverty and can barely make ends meet. So my question is whether it's possible to apply this knowledge in both of those economic fields, or is the doing zone like demanded of people who are in sort of those really more economically distressed states, or can they also take this? How does it work across the board?
Yeah, it's across the board. In fact, I had a client. This was a great example of how on the high, I can give you an example on both ends, but I had a client who owned eight companies. He was actually a very successful world-class athlete for years. And then he went on to have a tremendously successful career building eight very successful companies. And he was one of the most unhappiest people I've ever met. And it's because he was doing everything to prove himself instead of doing it to fulfill himself. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So what we did is we really stepped back and looked at each of his companies and what did he love about them. And it turned out there were only three companies that he really enjoyed what they did. He sold off the rest. And then he took what he earned from selling off those other companies and just running the ones that he enjoyed and built a nonprofit that was more fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And he went from probably one of the most miserable people I've ever met to one of the happiest people I've ever met. Mm-hmm. So it's a great example where somebody on the high end of the spectrum that's extremely driven and climbed that ladder was able to use the tools and techniques that I share to be able to turn his own life around. And then I've had a lot of people on the other end, whether they're as struggling as much with having to work two jobs to be able to make ends meet. A lot of times people get stuck in a job because they think that's all they know. And that's what's that I love about my background in human resources. I'm often able to help people see how their skills and gifts can take them beyond maybe that dead-end job where they're stuck and they feel they have to work two jobs to make things meet, and really look at how we can capitalize on their natural gifts and skills to be able to qualify them for something where they can go to one job. So that's maybe the other end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. where the tools and the techniques that are in the book and that I use in my coaching have helped people pull themselves out of poverty and stuckness and into a fulfilling career or life. Mm-hmm. I believe anybody in this world, if they choose to, can have an amazing life, but it may mean they need to change how they think in the world and how they react to stimuli in the world.
Right.
Because we tend to get into a place where we react based on our own life experiences, because our thoughts become our reality, mm-hmm. and our thoughts are very much based on what we experienced when we were growing up, especially in our formative years, and we're kind of hardwired for worry and stress because we want to fit in, we want to be liked, we want to make sure everybody else is okay, and we actually put ourselves into this stress stuck place by how we're responding to the world. And I teach people how to change how you respond to the world, whether it's, you know, COVID or fires or politics or whatever mm-hmm. else is going on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that hardwiring for negative thinking, which is how I jotted it down in my notes. But I think that's actually sort of off slightly, because I think negative is so judgmental in a way. It seems like perhaps when I think of what we're hardwired for, I think about sort of survival instincts. So when someone eats that berry and it makes them feel sick, but it doesn't kill them, they never forget that. And so they never go back and eat the berry again, which is seriously a survival instinct. And they're going to have a negative view, if we want to use that word, of that red berry for a very long time because it almost killed them. Well, that's a survival tool. That's why we exist. It's one of the sad things about the person who happens to eat their favorite food at the same time that they get the flu, and now they can never eat their favorite food again because it makes them nauseous.
Right.
Right. Right. So
Right,
we
right.
know if it's your favorite food and you want to like it again and you just can't get over the fact that you puked your guts out when you ate that food last time, you know, then obviously it is hardwired because we can't talk our way around it. If we've got these hardwired things in there, I think rather than resisting them or denying them or trying to label them as bad, it's more like if you can accept and acknowledge them as a as
Yes.
okay, as natural,
Yes.
okay, and simply true and real. And then it's almost like you release with that acknowledgement and it allows you to maybe feel like you have more empowerment going forward. Does that sound at all?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. There's some stats that are going around that were accredited to the National Science Foundation, and I've never found the original study, but it's all over the internet. And you know, the internet's always right, correct? But Google's never wrong. But
Never. No.
what they say, and it's been substantiated by different scientists in different ways, and just not quite how this is saying, but they say that we have like 12 to 60,000 thoughts a day, and it's probably how active you are and what you're doing. But they're saying like 80% of them are repetitive, and a high percentage,
Right.
like 95% of those, are negative. And there's actually a gentleman, Dr. Edward Watkins, he's a PhD, and his whole research focuses on depression, repetitive negative thought, and rumination. And so that's kind of what I'm talking about, is when you start having repetitive thoughts on something that doesn't feel right to you or good to you, whether you got sick from the berry, whether something in the news has bothered you and you just keep thinking about it, that repetitive thought process is kind of like if you think of a big field of grass and you just keep walking the same path over and over, you tread a path, right?
And then you
Well, the
follow the
same thing
path,
happens.
right?
What's that?
Then you follow the path,
Exactly. And that's
right?
what happens in your brain. It's like treading a path that you're going to keep following that same trail. And that, he says, the consequences of those repetitive thoughts are depression, anxiety, and he actually ends up affecting your health. And that's exactly what happened to me in my life, right? Is I was so intent on being successful and climbing the ladder and doing the right thing that I couldn't say no. And I kept treading this thing of that I didn't have the belly to say no. I just kept doing it.
Right.
If it, and then I stayed up all night.
Because
And
there's a reason
people do.
why, right? You know, I have to do this because here's my legitimate reason why. Oh, there's another thing. Oh, well, this
Exactly.
is my reason why. And that reason why
Yeah.
is that repetitive message that stopped you from saying, hey, I don't actually want to do this.
Right,
Got
right. And
it.
so they go into this worry, anxious mode, which is where I lived, and it starts to affect your health, which is exactly what happened to me.
Right.
And so I actually teach a tool that, because your thoughts and your repetitive thoughts become your reality, I teach a tool to people kind of to catch your thought, right? And it's in the book. You catch your thought when you're in it, like, oh my gosh, I'm so worried I might not do well on this test, or I have to have this done by tomorrow, or I will look bad to my boss, or whatever the case might be. But stop and catch yourself when you're in that repetitive thought process that's not doing you any good and causing you stress or causing you to be sick or causing whatever, and pull it out like it's a physical thing. And I actually learned this from a psychologist that I coached. But you pull it out like it's a physical thing, that thought. Let's say it's in your head. You reach your hand towards your head. You pull out that thought like it's a physical thing. You hold it in your hand and you tell that thought, you know what? I don't want to be stressed anymore. I don't want to listen to you anymore. I'm going to do this a different way. And you wad it up and throw it away. And it's amazing how calm your body becomes immediately.
Right, that makes a lot
Just,
of sense.
yeah, catching it and tossing it. Then you have to reboot and say what you do want. And
Right.
so when you focus on what you do want, that's another tool is you need to think, okay, so I'm always saying, oh, he's lazy, so he won't get it done, so I'm going to have to do it. Well, if I keep saying that, that's going to be my reality. Instead, maybe my coworker's a very hard worker and I need to trust them, right? And so if
Right.
I'm saying instead, well, I know George will get it done because he promised he'd have it ready by this time. I'm going to trust in that. And the more I believe in him, the more he's going to produce. And I found that as a manager over my years, the more I believed in my people and gave them responsibility and trusted it would get it done, the more likely it was going to get done.
Oh, and that
And
obviously is so true at home as well.
yes, with
Yeah.
children.
Well, and it doesn't matter with anyone because, you know, if you know
Yeah.
that someone else in the family thinks that you're going to fail and that you're not going to get something done, it just instantly creates all this yucky feeling. And then you yourself are more resistant to wanting to get it done because I think there's that sense of, well, if that's what you expect, then I'm going to fulfill that. So, yeah, we can go down
Right.
lots of rabbit holes, but I want to throw out there real quickly because you mentioned Professor Edward Watkins. And I
Yeah.
Googled him because I got my laptop sitting here. And yeah,
Yeah.
if you go to YouTube, folks, this guy, for example, it says Better Thinking Number 38. So apparently he's got a number of videos out there.
Yeah, he's been a cognitive behavioral therapist for over 20 years, and he's just really good with what I call, or what he calls, mood disorders. And when you're constantly going into slumps or not thinking you're enough or getting stuck or feeling whatever it might be, that's what, and it all goes back to your thinking. And so the key here to change your life, number one, is change your thoughts. Get out of how you think. And that's easier said than done because it took me a long time to start choosing my thoughts more wisely. Because I realized and I learned that my thoughts, and I saw kind of those percentages I gave you, your thoughts really are repetitive and you start thinking the same thing. So you've got to stop it. And that's why I have the throwaway tool. Every time I start to go down the rabbit hole, which I still do, we're all human, I start to go down that rabbit hole, I catch myself and I pull it out and I throw it away and I breathe and I ground and I start, now how do I want to approach this? What do I want? And then I'm saying the words of an example of turning it into a conscious thought to drive that into my brain. So I'm having the thoughts that I do want. And so I'll say things, and I usually tie a grateful to it as if it's already done. And the reason why is when you're really thankful for something, it makes it more likely, it feels good inside of you, and it feels more powerful. And so I might say, I'm grateful that I believe in my employee and that he's going to produce things on time. And when I'm saying that and I'm feeling that, it starts to become reality in my relationship with that coworker.
You know, I think it's interesting you bring up gratitude because a few days ago I had this, it was sort of like I'm in a situation with a family member, I think, in this situation, and I'm thinking that I wasn't feeling maybe appreciated for something I was doing. My next thought was, well, now that's interesting because if it's actually not that I want something, it's more that people who feel gratitude inherently feel more positivity or they feel better or they feel good because actually that's what gratitude is. Gratitude is this really positive feeling. And if you look at our culture, I don't think most people, if they're asked to list, what are the top five feelings that you call good? I think a lot of people would just skip over gratitude. They think of joy, pleasure, happy. They would go for those things. Because I think we have with this background Protestant culture, which has like some guilt and some different aspects to it, that's sort of a somewhat of a baseline for our culture. In a way, gratitude implies someone else just did something for you. Someone did you a favor. So for a lot of us in this culture, gratitude comes with a sense of debt. I think it makes us feel like we're indebted to someone. So it's almost like we're missing our opportunity to be thankful, grateful, and have gratitude because we're fearful of its twin, which is someone did something for me. I wasn't independent. I wasn't completely self-sufficient. Now I owe someone. So it seems to be our lack of gratitude is rooted in this sort of over independence aspect of our culture that makes it hard for us to really lean on each other and be interconnected in our community.
But there's also the other side of gratitude, and that's the gratitude that comes from within for things that you think and say and do within you that makes you more grateful for where you're at in life. And I tend to focus on that more versus always being grateful for what someone else is doing for me, but it's learning to be really thankful for the life I have, the opportunity I have that I can step back and I can look at this stuff. And so it's really more self-driven gratitude and thankfulness is what I focus on. There's a really
No, that's an
key part.
excellent demarcation. I think that's excellent.
Yeah. So, you know, that your thoughts become things. So what I'm saying with that is we tend to, as a society, live in our heads. Mm-hmm. And our heads, and I don't know if most people realize it, you think that you're making all your decisions in life based on your conscious brain. And everybody's really familiar with that conscious brain in the frontal part of your head.
Right. It's
your right and left brain, and that's your logic and your practical self and your creative self, right? But mm-hmm. science has proven we're only using like 5 to 10% of our conscious brain. The majority, and when I say you operate in your head and your thoughts become things, the majority of our actions and response in the world is from our what they call our subconscious brain or even our unconscious brain. And it's things that have been kind of ingrained in our cellular memory from our childhood and throughout our formative years.
Right.
And so what I do is I teach people to turn off, and that's pulling the worry out of your head, but turn off that subconscious brain by catching it and throwing it away and learn to listen to your body, because your body is where your intuition lies. Your body tells the truth. It does not lie. And that is why I've gotten really good at what I do is because I've learned the difference between when that little voice comes into my head and starts putting me into worry or into judgment or whatever it might be. And I've learned instead to listen to my other two brains in my body, which I don't know if most people know this, but your heart brain is actually the most powerful brain in your body. Mm-hmm. And right in line with that is your gut brain. And they put that more recently, scientifically, with what they call the vagal nerve or the vagus nerve. And that vagus nerve, right. The fibers in that nerve, it goes from your gut up to your brain. And 90% of the fibers in that nerve are carrying the information upward, not downward.
Interesting.
So, you know, when you say, I have this gut feeling I shouldn't do it?
Right.
That's a true thing. Listen to it.
Well, and, you know, interesting story about that is so this year I had a whole job lined up. I'd done training. I'd bought all my supplies, ready to go. I even started working the job January, February. And then, of course, you know, COVID hit, and I happened to be in a state that chose to do a lot of government alterations in order to prevent the spread of the disease, which is fine. I'm not complaining, but it did eliminate my job. So I'm like, okay, I need another job. So I ended up signing up to do the census. And it was really fascinating. In the training, this is federal. I was a federal employee for 2.5 months. And in the training, multiple times when it comes to the safety and security of employees, when they're training you on how to maintain that, multiple times it says in the literature, listen, literally these words, listen to your gut. If your gut tells you to walk away, walk away. So like here we are being, you know, they're not like assess it in this way or consider that, you know, they're not telling you to go to your brain. They know there are going to be moments where your gut, your intuition, whatever it is, something is informing you that your conscious brain is not aware of. And it's a valid piece of information. Please listen to it and obey it, you know, respect it. And I thought that was, I just kept thinking, wow, this is so cool. The federal government is like, you know, singing the praises of the gut. You know?
Yay. And it's
really
so
cool.
True. And here, the scary thing is we were actually told to turn off that reaction and not listen to our heart, which the heart, in my mind, is even more powerful than the gut when you learn to listen to it. Because it is, they did a electrocardiogram and showed that the heart brain is 60 times greater in amplitude than the conscious brain, and more messages are going up to your brain than down. And so between the heart brain and the gut brain, listening to your body along with your conscious brain, because that helps you get the logic through it, use all three together. That's when your life can absolutely transform, because you're doing things based on how things feel. But think about it. When a lot of people are young, big boys don't cry, you're told,
right.
Or you're told, oh, don't be such a crybaby, or be tough, toughen up, right?
Right?
So you're given all these messages that when you're really feeling something in your heart or your gut, you're shut down, and it's all about achievement and success. Well, achievement and success doesn't bring happiness. Happiness brings success, as my wealthy client description explained.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how rich you are, how much money you have, or how many nice things you have. It's how you feel.
Right.
It's the most important thing, because very wealthy people commit suicide because they're extremely unhappy. So,
and it always hits the news, you know. I mean, there's a few situations recently. I think there was a gentleman who was a journalist. There was a woman who was like a clothing designer or something, you know. And here are these people who, you know, appear to have everything, and then they do. They kill themselves, and, you know, people are like, oh, well, what was that? And there's this jump to this assumption that they had a mental disease called depression. But it could be that mental disease called depression that maybe led to the suicidal thoughts, which led to the suicidal action, that those things were preceded by this, as you say, this culturally taught sort of discount these and overly value those type of perspective. And then you get into thought processes that do not serve you.
I think if I tell you a client story right now, it might be really helpful in just confirming what you just said, because you are so accurate. You know, the wealthy client that I described one half of, but I had a client who was in a depression for 20 years, and her sisters actually hired me because her husband was actually the reason for the depression. And her sisters hired me to work with her, and I had to actually get on the phone with the husband and get his approval to work with her. And he said, and you have to start with a prayer and you have to end with a prayer. He was very controlling, thus her reason for depression, correct? And so she basically would stay in her room with blankets over her head and not want to come out, and only would go out for church and certain things that they did. The rest of the time, she just stayed in this depressed state, and she tried to commit suicide more than once. And that's when they felt the psychiatrist with all the drugs and the psychologist with all the what's wrong with you, instead of focusing on what's right with you, they felt it was ready for her to have a change. Mm-hmm. And so I worked with her for, you know, less than a year, and she came out of her hole, because what we did is we focused on what made her feel good, because her husband didn't make her feel good, and she was in a marriage and their religion didn't allow divorce, so she felt stuck, right? Thus wanting to commit suicide. But we really focused on things that would fill her up and make her happy, and so she started biking and walking and swimming and volunteering at the food bank, and all of those things brought hope and happiness to her life, and it shifted how she was handling life. And she no longer wanted to stay under the blankets and no longer wanted to commit suicide, because she had found things that filled her up. So it is about listening to how things feel, how your heart feels, your gut feels, and following it, and not just living in that subconscious brain that makes you feel small or stupid or not skilled or controlled or whatever the case might be.
And I think people in this culture especially are, for various reasons, a lot of us are scared, might be the best word, or unwilling to actually even share the truth when we know what it is. There are so many things that people want that are forbidden, or that are, you know, like, you know, in this situation you gave, this woman's faith precluded divorce. So because she was stuck between, you know, you can't actually say out loud what you really want or how you really feel, because it'll be judged. So imagine how many people, you know, might be in a situation where they're like, okay, well, I've been working towards this. Everyone around me thinks I want this, and doing this fits into this world, this bubble view of what's righteous and good. And if I suddenly say, you know, I changed my mind, this isn't making me happy, I don't actually want this anymore, I think I'm happier when I go over and do that, then there's all these people we sort of let down, we disappoint them, we shock them, you know, or they look askance at us. I mean, how often do you have someone who makes a significant change in their life, gives up a bunch of stuff, and the public narrative of that is, wow, that guy was really weird. He had it all and he gave it up to go be a hermit, or whatever their example is. And so, you know, it's like, I think a lot of us, we probably, if we really could speak honestly, we know what would make us happy, but we don't even feel like we can tell the people around us what we really want. So when you're self-censoring that much, how can you expect to be happy?
And there's another side to that too, which was my situation, where I loved my job in corporate America. And even though I loved my job and looked forward to going to it and knew I was making a difference, I was burning myself out because of the expectations of myself and wanting to please others and climb the ladder and look good, right?
Right.
And so there's the other side to that where it's not just going from being successful to being a hermit, or me leaving a leadership job in corporate America to be a coach. But there's the other side where you can be very happy and loving what you're doing, but not taking care of yourself.
Right.
And you hit the burnout stage, which is exactly what happened to me. And I ended up loving my new job too. So I was very fortunate, and I try to help people kind of look at all their skills and talents and amazingness. And instead of being judged for moving careers or changing how they operate in a career, but are seen as good people that are being successful because they're finally listening to themselves. I have clients that do exactly what I used to do, where they work around the clock and they keep saying, I want to be there for my kids, but I don't have the time or the energy. And they get home and they work into the evening. The kids are looking for their attention and they just keep, I'll get to it. And they never do, because then the kids go to bed. And so they're really missing out on a lot, which
right.
I did. You know, it affected my children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real thing. So, yeah, you can look at everything from so many different directions.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your book. So, I love the, I could be wrong, but I think back a number of months ago when you asked people what cover they liked, think I liked the one that you ended up choosing. Because I like it a lot. And I remember when I saw this, there were two, I think, or three you had put out. And I remember I was like, no, yay. I don't know. But I love the cover. It's brilliant. So, folks, this is called The Bean Zone. Let's talk a little bit about the book, the website, the different things.
Okay.
So we can, if you want, first of all, for folks who are just joining us, you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. My name is March Twisdale. I'm your producer and host of the show. And you're listening to 101.9 FM, KVSH, here on Voice of Ashon. You also might be listening over the computer. And that's a brilliant option, because sometimes you are driving home, listen to your radio show. You don't want to miss it, but you don't want to have to sit in your car for the next 18 minutes till the show's over. So you can always go to voiceofvashon.org and listen, you know, live stream over the internet. Or you can go listen to shows you've missed later, because they're all kept in the archives. So we are available. And right now I'm talking to Marlo Williams, who has written and published a book called The Bean Zone. And you can go to thebeanzone.com. Okay, this is bean, like B-E-I-N-G, like you're bean in the moment. And there's also, you said, Marla, that a couple of things you mentioned about the book. So first of all, it's the way it's laid out is, I would call it loosely laid out like a workbook, but not like people think of a workbook with a whole bunch of lines for writing things, you know, but it's more like it's a practicum almost. Is that how you view it?
I call it a guidebook.
There we go.
Because everybody's going to react to it different, and they're going to pick up the things that they connect with, and they can leave behind the things that they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But the book's in three major sections. The beginning of it is really learning why you are the way you are and how you got there and what you can do about it. And then the middle section really brings you into listening to your intuition and your body and really becoming present. And then the end of it, so that's about the transformational piece of it. So the first part's discovery, the second part's transformation, and the third part is about connection, because I believe that you have to learn to listen to your own energy as well as seek guidance from something greater than you to really get to where you want to go. And that section is on that. But so I call it a guidebook. And it is. It's kind of like a workbook. There's journaling and things. If you're really going to do it right, you go through all the exercises and you really can heal your life. If you just want to read it to see what it's all about and pick up some key messages, you can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be used whichever way you wish, but it is a book that I know can transform lives, and I'm already hearing that from some of the early readers.
Right. And as far as like the journaling part, you'd be like writing in your own journal. It's like the book is all words. It's not like a bunch of lines and empty pages to fill out.
Right.
Right.
But
right.
I do offer a journal that goes with it. It's called The Being Journal. And Amazon, I'm waiting on Amazon. I submitted it the same day I did the book, and for some reason it's not published yet, and I'm trying to get it published, so it should be out any time.
Awesome.
But there is a journal that you can purchase if you like to have everything in a nice, neat place. You can do it that way, but you don't have to. You can just grab a notepad and start writing.
Right.
And follow along with the prompts.
And so you were saying we that... go ahead.
I was just going to say we tried to make it flexible for people and how they want to work.
Oh, well, absolutely. It seems almost like that's like your middle name when it comes to this work that you do, flexible.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned that in this guidebook is completely accessible. I mean, I have it. You've sent it to me. I actually want to be able to really go through it on a personal level rather than trying to just read through it for this interview. So I have only scanned it at this point because I've got a couple of weeks coming up where I'm going to be able to devote to actually going through the book. And I wanted to do it right, so to speak. But,
good for you.
Yeah, but it is, from my reading of it, my viewing of it, it feels very accessible to the average person who is not trained in the realm of therapy, coaching, or something like that. So it's accessible to the people. But you mentioned to me that it's also actually quite useful for people who you've worked with who are in the field of, you know, therapy, counseling, psychology, whatever, that they themselves actually, when they coach with you, when you coach them, it actually helps them gain additional tools and insights. So you said this is useful really for people in that field of work as well.
Absolutely. Some of my clients that have been coaches or therapists or counselors or psychologists have actually loved working with me because not only, a lot of the people in that field, by the way, can get stuck because they're always hearing everybody's problems and that starts getting overwhelming to them. And my tools keep them from getting overwhelmed. So not only does it help them personally, but they were able to take the tools and all the things that I've taught and say, oh my gosh, I'm using this with my clients and I'm having so much more success. I have one client who says the tools that I taught her by far, and she went through all the years of training and worked as a psychologist and worked as a social worker. She said the tools that I taught her are the most valuable tools in her box. She's more successful with clients because of working with me than where she was after all her years of schooling and training.
Right.
In fact, she sent me one of her clients, and I started using one of my tools on her, and my client says, oh, my gosh, you sound just like... And I said, well, no, she sounds just like me. That's the tool I taught her. And so it was
yeah.
cute. But, yeah, so I've actually taken the book and developed a training program, an online training program, that I have the first module done, really close on the second. There'll be three modules total. But it is to help whether it's individuals who just want to make their life more astounding and amazing or for coaches and psychologists and therapists and counselors to take this course and make not only their own lives better, but learn all kinds of tools and the what and the why and the deep explanation behind all the tools
right.
so that they're more effective with their clients.
So this is
my coaches. Yeah.
Right. I'm sorry. So this is the Bean Zone system we're talking about now.
That is correct. Yes.
Right. And you have the first of three series basically that are, that's, I don't know what you call them, sections that's going to be produced.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when a person goes through all three, I'm actually going to call them certified in the Being Zone system. And I will actually, if they're interested and want to be on my website, will add their bio and picture and people can actually book or find them through there and then go out and book with them.
Right.
But it's a really powerful system. I've used it on over 1,200 clients. I know it works. And I've had a ton of success. And I felt like I needed to get this out to the world and share it.
I like here on the Bean Zone website, you know, it says learn to empower yourself and create the life you are meant to live. And then it goes through this list of things that I think pretty much everyone, especially right now, this show will be available in archive. So some of you might be listening in the future, but the show is being recorded right now in October 2020. So you can imagine as we're moving towards a fairly important election that there is a lot of energy out there in our society and in the world. So it talks here about how the Bean Zone helps a person make those inner alterations that can eliminate fear, calm anxiety, build self-esteem, help us discover purpose in life no matter what's going on in the outer world around us, and expand our happiness. So let's talk a little bit about the relevancy piece. After November 2016, there were recognizable spikes across the field of psychology, therapy, counseling, in patients coming in with really high levels of anxiety and really struggling because they were not happy, frankly, with the election results of 2016. Some people might have been thrilled, and that's fine. They're out there as well. But there was a notable impact on a certain number of people. So over the last 4 years, I personally have watched people that I know have known for a long time. Maybe I'm watching their Facebook feeds, and I'm getting the sense that a lot of people have an increased sense of anxiety, worry. There's just a lot of energy out there that seems to be centered around fear. And I'm wondering, for a person who is dealing with that, what is it that's going to make them feel okay with the idea of letting go of that when so many people, I think, perceive their fear and anxiety as not only legitimate, but actually an appropriate response, as if they are being the responsible person by feeling those feelings because they're taking the situation seriously, whatever the situation is. I think some people are going to resist letting go of those feelings because they think the feelings are proof that they are evaluating things correctly or responding appropriately. Do you understand what I'm trying to ask here?
Yeah, you're saying it really well. And here's the key with that is, yes, that fear is real, that anxiety is real, that feeling you're having, like I'm saying, listen to your body, and you feel it within your whole body, and it's very legitimate. But if you keep ruminating on it, you will only hurt yourself, and you'll actually alienate yourself from others when you chatter so much about it that there are actually better ways to deal with it. Doesn't mean you agree with it, doesn't mean you want to accept it, doesn't mean that it's what you want, but what you have to do is you have to think about yourself and take care of yourself. And that is setting an intention. When you are, and I know, Marsh, that you're a person that is very intentional about certain things and how powerful that can be when you do that. But the key is, go back to that concept of go ahead and feel through it. Go ahead and express yourself. Go ahead and go through all the emotions you're going to go through because that's part of the process and they're very, very real. But if you stay stuck in it, you're the one getting hurt. And so that's the point where you start pulling out that thought and say, I'm going to set that aside. I'm going to choose to move through the world and find the best way to deal with the world and do well by myself while I'm, doesn't mean I ever have to agree with it. I'm not sure I'm saying this very well. But how you respond to everything going on in the world and the outcome of the election is a choice. Whether it goes your way or not, it's a choice in how you respond. And it's really, really important that you do go through your feelings, but it's also very important that you take care of yourself and that you choose to address these issues with, I choose, and go back to that grateful statement, I am grateful that I am able to handle the outcome of this election with ease and grace. I will deal with what the next 4 years bring, but I'm going to continue to believe what I believe, but I'm going to do it in a more supportive, positive way so that I can get along with others or feel better in life. Because when you just get stuck in, oh my God, that's not who I wanted, that's not what I want, I feel like our world's coming to an end, you're going to stay there and you're going to go into depression and stuckness. And
And
it's
bring
not a
other
good
people
thing.
down with you.
The book will help, the training will help. You learn how to kind of overcome. Because could end up with even health issues, but you do have personal power over this. You just have to make a decision you're going to deal with it and move on after you go through the pain that you're going to go through if you do go through pain on this.
It's sort of like a person who is attacked, bitten by a dog, one day when they're jogging or when they're young or something. They feel fear because they're scared they're going to be attacked by a dog, and they feel pain, and those are completely legit. And then they have the choice. They can, in their mind, say, I am terrified this is going to happen again so I'm going to stop jogging. Or I'm scared it's going to happen. I'm going to get bear spray. And every time I see a dog, you know, that's not on a leash, I'm going to spray first and ask questions later. You know, there's all these different ways you can respond. And there's one that can say, okay, I've going to feel fear when I see a dog running towards me because of what happened last time. But I want to enjoy my jog every morning. And if I go out jogging and I'm fearful the whole time, I'm really negatively impacting myself. And the vast majority of the time I'm jogging, I'm never going to run into a dog. So all I'm doing is hurting myself when nothing else was hurting me. So how do you find a way to accept those feelings, but then still be the master of your own life and choose, you know, more, less anxiety and more of a choice of how am I going to handle this? So it's, if we take it away from politics and put it on the dog situation, I think maybe people can relate to that a little bit more because you have more control over where you jog and whether you grab bear spray or what you do about the dog. None of us have much control over what happens in Washington, D.C., so to speak.
No, we can't control it. We can only do what we feel is right. But you're right on the dog. In fact, I was out hiking with my dog, I don't know, it was last year sometime, and came across this man, and all of a sudden he just freaked out when he saw my dog and ran off the trail and got into the woods. And I'm going, are you okay? And he goes, I got bit by a dog when I was 5, and I can't be around dogs.
Aww.
So basically he'd been carrying this his whole life. And that is something that he could overcome with the tools that I teach.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like that might need to do a one-on-one coaching just to shift past that fear that he was carrying for his entire life.
Right.
But there's example after example after example of people that carry this with them, and it affects their entire happiness and health and wellness throughout their entire life,
right,
whether it's a dog or political, right? And you have a choice not to let that control your life.
Mm-hmm.
And there are solutions and there are ways through it. You just have to make a decision. And some people don't want to. I got to tell you, there's, you know, with all the people that want to work really hard and change their life, there's a lot of people that like where they're at because maybe they get more attention or maybe it's what they relate to and connect with in life and they can't imagine anything else. So people have to follow what feels right to them.
Yeah. And some people, it's not till the doctor sits them down and says, you need to stop or you're going to die, that, you know, a lot of people, that's what gets them. You know, that's when they make the decision to change.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly.
So, let's see here. I think people have a sense of the name of the book, where they can go to the website, thebeingzone.com. They can also go to your website, which is marlawilliams.net. And you do coaching. Real quick, if people have, is there like an initial coaching session that that's free? Does it have a cost right off the bat? How do people explore that option if they really want to actually work with a person, with you?
Right. I do offer a half-hour complimentary coaching call just to make sure people are comfortable with me and like my style. And so people can sign up for that online.
Mm-hmm.
And if they made progress and they feel good and they feel I can help them, then, and if I don't feel that it's a good match, I'll say it.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts with a complimentary session. And my business is picking up, so I'm not sure how long I can do that. It might go to 15 minutes at some point. But right now, you have a full 30 minutes.
Right.
And so that helps. But, you know, it's just that I've had so much success with so many people over the years. My whole goal in talking to you and writing the book and setting up the training is to help more people as much as I can, as cost-effectively as I can. I was coaching the CEO. The reason I wrote the book, I was coaching the CEO of a publishing company for a year and a half, and really helped her a lot. And she read a book over the holidays and came back to me and said, you know, I read this book and everything in it is what you have taught me. You really need to get the word out about what you do because it can change lives. So when a CEO of a publishing company encourages you to do something with what you do, you do it, right?
Absolutely. And then I believe that you and I, it was the same summer that we met that you met Bruce Lipton. Is that true?
That is correct. That is correct. In fact, shortly after the CEO told me to, you know, maybe write a book, Bruce Lipton is someone I follow. His biology of belief is the foundation of a lot of things that I do and say.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to be chosen to participate in an event, which is where I met you, March.
Right.
And came up and met Bruce. And that was a life changer. But as through that process, I had learned I needed a really good developmental editor because I had so much data I was trying to put into this book that Bruce's assistant introduced me to his editor, and his editor was a life changer for me. She helped me take this big pile of stuff that I know and helped me condense it into what could be in a book. Mm-hmm. And it was a phenomenal process. I believe with the right editors and the right help and the right support and people that believe in you, anybody can write a book, you know, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. It's been a wonderful, I never knew I'd be an author, and I'm excited
right.
that I am one, and I'm excited I'm doing it in a way that can make a difference in this world.
Yeah. Yes. And I hear from you the value and the difference it made having those specific supports, those people who were there encouraging you and giving you insights.
Yeah.
I would like to, the word condense, I'm going to challenge that just a little bit because I'm worried people will have a sense that it means it's a giant Bible of a book that's super dense. It's not dense. The book
no.
has such a good visual to it. I mean, just from the cover on through, everything feels excellent, you know, and I see a lot of books and sometimes the text is really small or things feel too blocky or whatever, but no, it looks like it's going to be a really wonderful read. And I'm just super glad you were willing to take the time and in your life to, as you say, you know, pull all this information together and put it into such an accessible and meaningful and understandable venue or platform. And then of course what you're
yeah.
doing with the Bean Zone system. I mean, so thank you very much.
You are welcome. It was written from the heart, and I think you will feel that as you read it.
All right. Well, that is our time. So I really appreciate you coming on the show.
I appreciate you having me. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Excellent. And folks, you've been listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSH. This show is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. I am your host and producer, March Twisdale. You've been listening to Marla Williams, who has written a book called The Bean Zone, and you can learn more about it at her website, thebeanzone.com. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, and we'll see you next week.